The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Case 55 of the Blue Cliff Record. Dao Wu's condolence call. Dao Wu and Qian Yuan went to a house to make a condolence call. Yuan hit the coffin and said, "Alive or dead?" Wu said, "I won't say alive. I won't say dead." Yuan said, "Why won't you say?" Wu said, "I won't say." Halfway back, as they were returning, Yuan said, "Tell me right away, teacher. If you don't tell me, I'll hit you." Wu said, "You may hit me, but I won't say." Yuan then hit him. Later, Dao Wu passed on. Yuan went to Shi Shuang and brought up the foregoing story. Shuang said, "I won't say alive and I won't say dead." Yuan said, "Why won't you say?" Shuang said, "I won't say. I won't say." At these words, Yuan had an insight. One day, Yuan took a hoe into the teaching hall and crossed back and forth from east to west and west to east. Shuang said, "What are you doing?" Yuan said, "I'm looking for relics of our late master." Shuang said, "Vast waves spread far and wide. Foaming billows flood the skies. What relics of our late master are you looking for?" Shuido added a comment saying, "Heavens, heavens." Yuan said, "This is just where I should apply effort." Fu said, "The late master's relics are still present." So this question, alive or dead, and Yuan's urgency, "Please, I have to know." This was brought home to me so vividly last January. January 3rd, 6 a.m., the alarm goes off. I get up and in my usual way make my way toward the shower. And the next thing I'm aware of is a kind of pinching on my forehead. And my eyes open, and it's 4 hours later, and an emergency room doctor is sewing up a gash in my forehead. And it took a long time for me to understand where I was. I was on my way to the shower. So I learned that I passed out. I fell down the stairs, whacked my head, and then have no memory for 4 hours of time. And apparently I woke up after a few moments. And then when they got me to the emergency room, I was chatting with the doctors and the nurses and the staff. And actually, apparently I was quite pleasant and I was making friends. And so then 4 or 5 hours later, people would come into my room and like they knew me. And talk to me as though we had already met. And then they would look at me and my bewildered face and they would say, "You don't know who I am, do you?" So, alive or dead? I still have no memories whatsoever of that huge period when so much happened. It is for me like an iron wall, a nothingness. Completely different from sleep. We're asleep, we awake, we know we've not been so aware, but we've been dreaming. This was utter blankness, and it remains so. And what it brought up for me was this question of life and death. So yes, I was alive. But my experience was of nothingness. No experience. Not present. And particularly no awareness. And what I came to understand was, as I investigate this question of life and death, that awareness keeps rising. As the bedrock of my life, that no awareness was that iron wall, was that nothingness. And it remains as a touchstone for me. So we don't think about our awareness much, really, because we've never thought of being without it. But here, we keep talking about turning toward, about turning our awareness toward our life. Imagine the miracle of having the capacity to do that. That we take for granted. But it's astonishing. And I've come to see that for me that is the jade contained in the stone. That the stone doesn't always realize the flawlessness of the jade. That until this happened to me, I didn't have the same sense of the flawlessness and the miraculousness of this awareness that we are swimming in. And something else happened to me. I found that as I recovered, and it took months, that I was much more keenly aware of when I felt aliveness, when I felt energy, whether it would be in a conversation, whether it would be in a meeting, whether it would be walking down the street, aware of aliveness and aware of what was deadening, of what sapped away energy. And there was something about this experience that made it more and more urgent for me to find the aliveness where I was. And so here is the question for you as you ponder this matter of life and death. Can you notice what enlivens you, what gives you life? And what deadens you? And when, as we all are, we are in those situations that feel deadening, is there a place of aliveness even there? For me, this has become the awareness of something miraculous that I took completely for granted. That at the end of the road, it's an iron wall, and so, as the ghost urges us, do not squander your life. Do not squander this miraculous awareness.
So this miraculous awareness Lin Chi talked about this mysterious functioning, the effortless functioning. Often we are so conscious of how hard our life is, how much work it takes to meet ourself, to meet the circumstances of our life. And yet all the while this teaching, already awake, and what could this mean, given that our experience is, well, sometimes I'm awake and feel alive and I'm clear, and other times I feel exhausted and confused. This iron wall of, might say the iron wall of this present moment, we want to understand. And yet so often we feel we cannot get through. Juan, knocking on the coffin, had an urgent question, and he was stuck. And he was stuck apparently for a long time, first with his teacher. I don't get it. I don't get it. And he was a stubborn and determined fellow, though, and had the great capacity, apparently, for being stuck. Some of you, I've noticed, have this capacity as well. This is a very important capacity. Robert Aitken said, does the persimmon complain about being stuck on the tree? Does the persimmon complain about being stuck on the tree? I'm up here on the tree. How come I'm not ripe yet? I don't like this. No. Maybe if you listen very carefully, but maybe the persimmon quite fine to be unripe, and then fine to be ripe. We say awakening, this insight, you cannot force it. William Blake said, you cannot storm the gates of heaven. I want my awakening and I want it now. I've been here for a day and a half already. Gosh darn it. Or some of us, talking to our great friend and priest David Caruso, who said 50 years ago he started. He is a very slow learner. And we are grateful for the slowness of David, which is the slowness of this David and you, all of us on this journey. So we get stuck. And this effortless functioning. We're stuck. How come I can't get this? How come I can't get that? And all the while, breathing in and breathing out. Hearing the sounds of the birds and the traffic. All the while feeling aching knees. Meanwhile, life goes on. There's a wonderful Native American song that I encountered for me almost 50 years ago that goes like, why do I go about pitying myself when all the time I am being carried on great winds across the sky? Why do I go about pitying myself when all the time I am being carried on great winds across the sky? We go on. Not a problem to pity yourself, not a problem to complain, to be angry, to be frustrated, to be lost, not a problem. The teaching is that in this moment, everything you need to wake up is here. Everything you need is already here. And at the right moment, at some moment, you will wake up. So in our story, Juan, when he heard the exact same thing, still stuck maybe years later, exact same thing, exact same words, suddenly he had some insight. He had an awakening. There was a turning about. That he did not manufacture and did not think his way into. This awakening, or these moments of awakening, are not, as we were saying yesterday, not permanent and fixated. But yet there is a shift. There is a shift moment by moment, a turning about in the deepest part of our soul. That comes of its own accord. We do not get to decide the timing of our life, but we can decide the direction of our life. What is the direction you are heading in? And then it is endless. So whether you've now been around practicing for 50 years, of retreats, or if this is your first retreat, it makes no difference on this endless journey. If we're talking about infinite distance, then 2 miles or 3 miles or 50 miles makes no difference. But we have the great pleasure of walking in the direction of what we love, walking in the direction of what is most important, and then where and when insight comes is none of your business. That is above your pay grade. You are not in charge of your life. But as we take one step, then Xuan comes back into the Dharma hall with his ho, walking here and walking there. This is his presentation of what he has understood. Wow. What was it that he understood? What was it? What was the way out? What happened to him as he ripened and then ripened again? What happens to you? Sitting these long hours as you ripen and ripen again.
Part three. I remember a newscaster, I can't remember his name, someone who was on the radio when I was a little girl, who would read the news from a script and he would say, page 2, in the middle of a sentence. So this koan for me has been also evoking the past. 40 years ago, I first heard this from my first teacher, our first teacher. And he had a deep, melodious voice, and I always still hear his voice saying, "I won't say, I won't say." And in a way that went deep into my heart and became a personal koan. Why won't you say? Tell me. I just want somebody to tell me. How do I live a life as a human being? And I have studied with Zen teachers and other kinds of spiritual advisors and psychologists and coaches, and I always want them to tell me. And pretty much all the best ones say some variety of, I won't say. I'm so struck by the emphases of Bob and David this morning. The touching upon what we talked about yesterday a little bit, the vividness of life, which might be something that is not appealing to you, and that's okay. But the sense that Bob had after his accident of sensing into what is something that is important in this moment, where do I want to put my energy? And the promise that David talks about, this promise of fully realizing through the very things that appear to be parts of ourself or parts of the world that we don't like, these Dharma gates of confusion and tiredness, physical pain, all the things that come at Sesshin. These are Dharma gates to something that can't be spoken about, and yet we blab on, don't we? Yeah. It's one of our great tools as teachers to find words for things. But ultimately, there is nothing to say. And the question that prompted the I won't say is a very interesting kind of a question. It's a question that is in the minds of all human beings that I've ever met, wanting to split the world into, to say, is it this or is it that? And then in our great ignorance, our delusive certainty, we say, it is this and it is that. And we make all kinds of trouble. Those people, or me, some definition of a problem. The problem with you is, you are, you know, I don't have to even fill in the blank. And what do we do when someone comes to us and says, the problem with you is? What do we do? Or when someone comes and says, the problem with me is? We need to see the arising of this great desire for duality, to make things certain. Many of you know the koan, which I found out is about the same fellow, Yuan Wu, our friend, who says, I won't say, I won't say. Someone comes to him on pilgrimage, and Wu says to him, where are you going? And he says, I don't know. I'm wandering about on pilgrimage. And Wu approves of him. He says, oh, not knowing, that's the most intimate. So we fall down the stairs. We lose 4 hours. We come to Sesshin and lose everything. Hopefully, I'm hoping this for you. We reach the end of our life and take our last breath, alive or dead. I want to know. I have a friend, a dear friend, who she's not a Zen practitioner, and she... She really wants to know whether there's life after death. And we have a pact that if there is life after death, we're going to come back to the remaining friend and say, there is life after death. My suspicion is that whichever one of us goes first, there'll be something unimaginable on the other side, and we won't be able to come back, and that will prove that there's no life after death. Certainty. You're like this. He's like that. She's like that. This is like this. Those people. I'm so certain I know what your problem is. I'm so certain I know why I'm so screwed up. The narratives. And Wu won't buy in. Alive or dead, I won't say. Well, I'm going to hit you. I'm so upset. I'm going to hit you. That's okay. I'm so committed to not making categories that I'm going to let you hit me. The little piece of the story that we mentioned where after the hitting, the teacher sends the student away, Wu sends Yuan away, And he has these adventures where he has some actual openings, some what we call enlightenment experiences or awakenings. In our tradition, this is never a final moment, although a lot of the stories end with, and then he had an enlightenment experience. In our way, we understand that there are many, many moments of opening, many insights. In this particular translation, after that final, I won't say from Shixuan, Yuan has an insight. Whatever we call it, we have to be careful, because calling it enlightenment, calling it an insight, calling it anything, contributes to the desire for categories. Better to say, I won't say. And then to actually demonstrate the meaning of what it means to have someone in your life who you are devoted to, who dies, or who has been devoted to you, who goes away. This happens over and over and over again, because change is part of being human. Life and death, the endings of things. And this wonderful, wild person grabs a hoe and walks around the zendo looking for his dead teacher. My first teacher is also dead. Many people in my life have died. Many people have changed and shifted and gone away. Are they truly, truly gone? Are they here in the billowing clouds that float over the temple? Are they here in the sound of the birds and the traffic? I won't say. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. Feel free to turn in this direction. We're going to have our discussion, our Dharma dialogue.
Yeah, in the back, Will?
Yeah. Oh, hi, Will.
Hard to see. It just strikes me as a very strange condolence call. I find myself wondering about who is being consoled. And then I was thinking about etymologies, and I wanted, you know, of course it's Chinese, so I can't say, but using the English, condolence, condolere in Latin, is the same as sympathy, which comes from grief, suffering with. And I don't really know what the question is, but what about these people who are supposedly being comforted by the visit? You said it's not a funeral. Why don't we hear about them? Are we suffering with them? Is someone suffering with them? Or some other meaning of condolence? What's happening there?
Well, I think that when someone dies, we're all confronted with this question. Right? You know, so we think condolence is, oh, I'm really sorry for your loss. But maybe entering in, what happened? Where did this person go? Alive or dead? In some ways is what's happening in that moment. So we can imagine, were the people upset? Were they heartened?
Oh, knock on the coffin.
Right. What's going on here? To me, when I have been, I was present when my grandmother died, and it was utterly mysterious. You know, same thing when our daughter was born. Where did you come from? You know, this great coming and going. And maybe the kindest thing we can do when we're with someone who is confronted with this is to be there with them at the cliff edge. What is this? Thank you.
Mm.
Alan.
As you know, I've heard you talk about your fall before, but never in this way. And, you know, I never knew that you had this 4 hours where you were not alive, not dead, where you were, you know, talking and chatting and meeting people, but not. And I was really struck by that. And I just have to tell you something you don't know about my fall. You know, Bob knows that a few months before I had fall, kind of similar except less dramatic, because I wasn't at the top of a stairway. I was in my partner's bathroom and just felt like a tree on my head and was not concussed, I guess. Although, but my first memory was her shaking me and saying, wake up, Alan, wake up. Yeah, yeah. And I was going in and out of consciousness and dream states. And she told me later in the hospital, in the emergency room, that I had said at one point, this is really happening.
This is really happening. Yeah.
And I remembered saying that. And it was because, you know, I was being pulled so hard by the dream side.
Yeah.
And it would be so much better if it weren't. You know, and as you were talking about the way that you reacted to this in your life, you know, I was thinking that for me, it's been partly, you know, that there's so many times when to all intents and purposes I look fully awake where I'm in that dream state, and I tried to get better about saying, oh, this is really happening. Oh, I'm really talking to and being confronted by another human being.
Yeah.
Oh, I've really got a student across the desk from me who's asking me a question.
Yeah.
Oh, you know. I'm really, you know, eating this rice. And so it was just really, really striking to me how we had our different faults and they led to different but parallel new ways of living our lives.
Yeah. First of all, I need you to talk to my wife, because she will say that I've gotten really good at nodding like I'm listening and I really know what you're saying. And it's like, this is not really happening. What I'm interested in is this experience that I think we all have of you know, that autopilot where you're driving a well-known route. You know, you're driving from home to work and you realize, how did I get here? What happened along the way? And so much of my life can be that, right? And so that feeling of, this is really happening, that I think some of that is what Sashin helps us to kind of do, like, oh, this is really happening. The first time I read The Five Remembrances, oh my God, this is really happening. Old age, sickness, and death. And so I just want to resonate with that feeling of, my God, like, so much of my life gets squandered not knowing that it's really happening. Mm. So, thank you.
Well, I want to speak up for the dream world.
Yeah.
And this is not really happening.
Yeah.
Because that's also true. There's some way that this whole thing, we think, you know, we've got this representation of reality in our little brains, and really, who knows what's going on? It's quite a mystery. It's a big part of the Zen teachings. It's called the realm of the Sambhogakaya, where it turns out, neurologists are saying it's actually important to have these moments of spacing out, because without them, it wears the brain out. We need to go back and forth. So you both had extreme experiences of it that lasted a really long time, although I would say that some people have lifetimes of it.
Yes.
And part of Zen is, you know, when we're in the dream, to appreciate the dream, and then it changes into, this is really happening. And it's always moving. There's not, you know, I won't say is the direct teaching about, it's not this and it's not that, because we want it to be this or that. I figured it out. Yay, I know how to be a person now. I can't tell you how many times I've said that.
and that we can make spacing out the enemy here.
Yes.
Right? And you're saying no.
No, because you are like really, You know, you made all these friends, and they will love you forever.
I hope so.
And, you know, and when we're in the car and we haven't driven off the road been in an accident. You know, 99% of the time, and so there's something going on. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if any of you have noticed here at Sesshin that you may have moments like that here, where you're just sitting and, you know, Jenny rings the bell and then a second later she rings it again. Mm-hmm. What just happened? Yeah. You were in the Sambhogakaya for a little while. Mm-hmm. Or maybe in the Dharmakaya, which is the absolute, where there's just nothing, you know, the iron wall. Mm-hmm. But all these states are very important and we move through them. There's nothing permanent. So to stay curious about our own experience, very, very important.
Yeah.
And hopefully, I've heard this story a few times now from you, Bob, I keep thinking, oh, I hope when I'm out of it that I'm also really nice to you. You know, the basic stuff.
My grandmother, before she died, suffered from Alzheimer's and got very sort of mean, but also started talking about her personal life in ways she never had. She was very reserved woman, and would talk about lunch with this guy or that guy. And I visited her once with my mother, and after we left, I turned to my mom and said, I can't wait till this happens to you. So, we don't know.
We don't know. We don't know who it's going to be. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Chris. I was struck by the phrase, the desire for dichotomy, or the desire for duality.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And while we're sharing gruesome stories.
Oh, dear.
Well, let's use our judgment.
But I went through a period where I was waiting on test after test after test after test, and when I had that tumor on my spinal nerve that I removed, and there was just, it went on and on and on, and I kept thinking, I just want, and I couldn't finish the sentence, but I think that what I wanted was duality.
Yeah.
It wasn't that I wanted life, and it wasn't that I wanted death. I wanted to be in a place where someone could say it's this or this.
It's certainty, right?
Or even the idea that there was a specific choice, that there was, that the world of uncertainty could somehow be categorized or be resolved.
Yeah. There really is a longing for it.
Really,
When we're sick or injured, we want a name for what's going on, so that we can get treated and fix it. And you know, it's
but
it's
doing a koan even.
Yeah, so. I want to pass my koan.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, the passing the desire for the certainty sometimes gets in the way of being present in the mystery of the symptoms. Mm-hmm. You know, and then we think, oh, great, it's this. Now I can get, sometimes, you know, surgery is a magical, wonderful thing. But so often in human bodies, there's nothing to do. Or the things that there are to do don't bring us the relief. They have their own problems. And on and on and on it goes. But we do, I think everyone I know longs for duality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for certainty.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that in.
Yeah.
It's so funny, when I was a kid, I loved reading mysteries. And then as an adult, I'm like, I only want certainty. And then so the mystery, I like the emphasis on the mystery. I don't really like the emphasis on the mystery.
Interesting.
maybe you mentioned this and I missed it because I'm in and out of the dream states, but this would drive me nuts, just like that student. Why did the teacher say, I won't say? That to me implies he knows something. And I understand. Why did he just say, I don't know? Then I could accept I don't know. But someone saying to me, I won't say, is like, well, you know and you won't tell me?
Yeah.
I go mad.
Why do that?
Especially if it was about life and death. I'd be like, and you know?
Yeah.
And you're not telling me?
Yeah, yeah. So you really...
Everyone has wanted this for life a whole entire life.
Right, right. So you're really entering into the koan now.
Yeah.
Right? This is how we do koan work.
Oh.
Exactly.
Right? Not a joke here. Like there's this is the urgency we were talking about. So the teacher doesn't say, well, I don't know, there's really no answer to that question. Right? But he refuses to tell. He refuses to put words on it.
Does he know?
Fair.
Does he really know?
Well, he's pointing to this world beyond knowing, beyond categories. You know, and he's being very strong about it. And so, you know, I can't tell you how many times in Doksan over the last 15 or 20 years that I've really wanted to tell people the answers to koans. You know, it's like, it's just this. Yeah. But it would not serve. Right. It doesn't serve. And the people who stick with it and go away, you know, why won't you say, and then come back. One of the things I love about Yuan is that he comes back a number of times to this matter. He's just not satisfied. And that's such a great characteristic in a person of the way. Right?
You could save him so much suffering.
Oh, no.
You wish.
You wish. Listen to what Bob is going to say. Bob's going to lay it on you.
So I'm going to lay it on. I'm going to lay it on you now. So I was reading some commentaries about the koan, and many of the commentaries talk about the great kindness of Wu, who says, "I won't say, I won't say." Why is that a kindness? And my thought was, he knew learning theory. So modern learning theory tells us that when we have to struggle with something, when we have to grapple with something, when we don't know and our minds have to reach and our hearts have to reach, that we learn in a completely different way, in a way that makes it ours, in a way that we retain. So if Wu had some, he could have given any number of answers. If he'd had some answers and just handed it over, as we find now, in you know, that it is the struggle and the grappling that you're doing right now with this point of the koan. That's why David said, you're entering in. You're living into it. That's what, at its best, that's what koan practice is.
That makes sense.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks. Great question.
Yeah. Dana.
I've been trying to wrap my head a little bit around what keeps coming back to just the physicality of it, because I think that I used to work in a hospice, and when the conversation started a little bit about like condolences, like who's comforted by this, what's going on here, I at least found that people very rarely want to be comforted, they want someone to be there.
Yeah.
And when someone's dying, they might not be able to communicate, but they're still there. But are they? It's that alive or dead, alive or dead, and who's the teacher going on there. But typically I find people just want there to be someone that they feel confident is alive.
Yes.
They want
beautifully
someone to be there because it's physically like a confirmation of all the things we're already thinking. That clearly this person is not that scary thing. And when that person does go, or even in this, it's like the teacher, as soon as he's physically gone, it's like latching onto a new teacher. Like wanting to not quite look at the being gone, or to trying to turn it into something else. And so he physically hits the man when he's not sure what's going on. And I think that it's interesting that we come here in a group, and that you can't do this by yourself, because then you just wind up in your own head.
Right.
The whole time, and you forget you're physically something, and you physically sometimes need someone else there to reassure you of things.
Yeah.
And so this was just
exactly.
Kind of reflective.
Well, and I think it is this transmission we talk about. So the great secret that is, we say it's an open secret. Right? So not so much that we have something that you don't, but it is about this presence. It is about all of us get in these places that we don't need someone else to comfort us. We don't need someone else to tell. I mean, we sometimes wish we had that, please. But I find most people, like every once in a while, my daughter will call up and like really want me to tell her something. It's a trap. She is a grown woman and actually knows what she wants, but she does want something.
Yeah.
And we do need, we need each other, we need teachers, not because our teachers have our answer. You know, and if so, I give an answer, and it's not your answer. You know, and I am not the authority of your life. I am a Zen teacher, and I am playing this role of authority. But the point of it is for you to begin to trust more and more your authority, your experience, and we so need each other. Yeah.
Physically being there.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, thank you. Zeth?
I was also kind of taken by the I won't say answer. And I had a kind of weird reading this time for some reason where you could read it as like a, not a statement about intention, but just a statement about what's going to happen, almost like a prediction. Like, it's going to rain tomorrow. I won't say. And then the question is, why won't you say? And there's this rebuke, you know, that why is made up, right? And in some ways, like, the I won't say is actually the answer, but he refuses to hear it because he wants the why. But just, there's no why.
Yeah. Well, that's such an important insight that I won't say is the answer.
Is the answer.
Right? That it's not that he's fooling around or making a problem here or trying to trick people, or this is part of the kindness. You know, the direct response is you see it in all the koans. Sometimes it sounds like the teachers are being mean, you know, but you know, they're saying this is it exactly. There's another wonderful koan where somebody has one of these burning questions and goes from teacher to teacher to teacher, and they say things like, I can't tell you, I have a headache today, or I don't know the answer to that, or why don't you ask the other teacher? You know, and it just keeps going, and I love this guy because we get it. After a while, we say, oh, I can't tell you, I have a headache is the answer, or I don't know is the answer. He's not getting it. He has a very specific, narrow view of what he wants. And so does Yuan in this story. So, that is the answer. I won't say. How wonderful.
And it reminds me of our Om Nam chanting, where we call out. So we call out, and then the instruction is to receive what arises as the answer. So we might say that everything is the answer to your question. The taste of your food, the sunlight coming in, but we're looking for a particular, well, I don't want that kind of answer, I want, but the possibility that this is the answer.
Just as we've been talking about this, I have this thought that, because my mind's been doing this, is our minds are so attuned to words that we think the Mu gave a word answer. And it struck me that it's more like something we ought to call a demonstration or like a pantomime than a concept with words that stands for something and has an inherent word meaning that we need to figure out.
Well, the cool thing about using that word demonstration is that everybody's always demonstrating themselves. Part of the job of teachers, all people of the way, students, teachers, is to recognize the demonstration. So sometimes it comes in words. Sometimes it comes in words that are off base somehow, that not unexpected, like surprising. And I keep thinking of all the Doksan strategies that we all do. And I've done them myself. You know, first I'm going to go in, I'm not going to let the teacher really see who I am. And I want to show up as a smart person. So I'll spend all my time in the chair waiting, figuring out some great theory to present. That's a state. People, right? It's not just me who did that. I think there are other people who do that too. You've never done that. And then there's my strategy is I'm going to come in and just demonstrate who I am. And I'm going to do this. So it's some stretch. I'm going to figure it out. And there, you know, this is the Doksan relationship is a skillful means for learning how to not get in our own way and trust that we're demonstrating ourselves no matter what we say or do, and then we can be received by the teacher. Where else does that happen? I don't know any other place that happens, really. Maybe in therapy with some very gifted therapists, but mostly everybody's got their ideas about, and their two ideas crashing. That's also a demonstration, right? And when we come in with our brilliant insights, that's also a demonstration. And when we come in with our walls, that's also a demonstration. And there's some way that we start to align with it so it's not a problem anymore. And the bell rings, or the Jisha announces, we put out our card. Jisha comes, we bow. No fuss, no muss. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're demonstrating.
And I think, too, a demonstrate or embody or manifest.
Right.
In our Zazen, we are demonstrating our true love. Right? When we cut vegetables, we are manifesting our Buddha nature when we walk, when we sweep the floor. And I think one thing I so appreciate about Zen is that it's not in some abstract way.
Right.
So it's not in the words. It's not like I need to understand another concept.
Yeah.
Oh, if I just understand form and emptiness. No. That's pointing to something. That is demonstrating itself. The universe is always giving itself to you, and we are always at every moment for ourselves and for each other, manifesting ourself, being ourself. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So, thank you all.